Welcome to Inspirational Tales. When my guests on this podcast experience the most challenging times of their lives, they use these hardships to learn, grow, and better themselves. And as a result, they are now thriving in life. Their stories are ones of resilience, strength, and overcoming adversity. So sit back and join me as we celebrate them turning their challenges into triumphs. My guest on this episode is Bobby Hendry. Bobby grew up in the foster care system in New South Wales, frequently moving homes and schools. To give you an idea of how many times she moved, by the time she was 18, she had lived in 40 different houses and with 16 different families. But when Bobby was 15 years old, she had finally settled into a school and was enjoying her time there when her current living arrangements fell through and she was about to be moved again, this time into a group home. It was during this time that two of her teachers decided to take her in. After years of moving around and not knowing where she would be living in the future, Bobby finally found herself in a loving home with stability and a family that wanted her as part of their own. Bobby is now a wedding photographer, whose photos will forever be a reminder of some of the happiest moments in her clients' lives. Having very few photos of her own childhood, she understands the importance of capturing these special moments. She also completed a photography project where she revisited the 40 different houses that she had lived in until she turned 18. Bobby has an incredible energy and attitude towards her life. The often challenging experiences that she faced throughout her childhood taught her many valuable life lessons that she has carried into her adult life. In this interview, Bobby is so open and honest in sharing her story, and I hope that by hearing it, you will gain a better understanding of what many children face growing up in the foster care system like she did. Hi, Bobby. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today. How are you?
Yeah, doing really good. Lockdown is ending, feeling hopeful and positive about all the fun things that will be going ahead, should be going ahead, and hopefully will be.
Yeah, being able to get back into your photography must be a great feeling.
Oh, yeah. I'm so excited to get back to work. It's been, I think it'll be 6 months of not being able to work by the time I get to shoot my next wedding, which, yeah, I'm just so excited for. I really hope I still remember how to use a camera.
Oh.
Fingers crossed.
Oh, you will.
Yeah, I'm sure. No,
I'm sure you'll
be like
will.
Riding a bike.
So today we're going to speak a bit about your journey in foster care and then obviously what you are doing now with your photography and all of that. But I do feel like this is a topic that many people don't seem to know too much about. I know myself personally, I haven't been involved in anything to do with foster care or adoption or anything like that. And I feel like a lot of people like me in the general public don't really have much of an understanding of what happens and what it's like. Do you think that that's a valid thing to say? Like, has that been something that's come up along the way for you?
Yeah, I feel like it's the sort of thing that people don't actually know much about unless they have some level of personal experience with it. You know, whether their mother had a foster sister or, you know, their cousin is a, you know, a foster kid or something. Usually, it's something that people are aware of. You know, they know it happens, but they don't really think about it too much or don't like to think about it. So I think that is it. Yeah, there's not really much knowledge out there about, you know, the statistics of anything or, yeah, other than, I guess, the rare movies that are out there. It's not really in the public sphere too much because it's not really a fun topic. So I think that, yeah, it's absolutely a valid thing to say.
So you were 8 years old when you went into foster care, but do you have much memory of your life before that?
Yeah, I actually have a pretty good memory. So I remember, yeah, pretty much my whole childhood. So I was actually about 7, almost 8 when I went into foster care. But up until then, I was born in Coffs Harbour. I lived there till I was six with my mum and dad and my two brothers. My parents split when I was about like 2 or 3. And I mostly lived with my mum, then visited my dad who lived down the road most weekends. I feel like our childhood and our life seemed pretty normal from the outside. Like we played soccer every week and we did nippers and we got awards and detentions in school. But my parents' relationship was not a healthy one at all. My dad was really not a great dad. He was really violent and abusive. And, you know, between the bruises he put on me and my siblings, as well as my mum, like it was clear to my mum that more distance was needed for our safety. So one night we like stowed away into her friend's truck. They used to like move magazine subscriptions to newsagents, like all up the East Coast. So we like stowed away in there, went all the way to Sydney. And then from there, we jumped around from refuge to refuge because my dad just kept finding us somehow. And then, one night, my mum, I think she just realised, you know, she really desperately wanted us kids to have a healthy, stable, happy childhood, and she just couldn't do that for us in her current state. So one night, she slipped out of the refuge we were at and just waited until a caseworker came to take us away.
Wow. So how many, you said we, how many children did she have?
So I have an older brother and a younger brother.
Okay. So she went back to the refuge and you went into the foster care system. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I remember her telling me the story from her point of view. There was this park across the road from the refuge, and she said she left and she waited in these grandstands and waited till the morning until she saw, you know, like a company fleet car come to put us in her car and take us away.
That must have been horrendous.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine doing it, but I think that was the thing, you know, she was up against so much. Like, she loved us to pieces. She was a really good mom. She tried her absolute best every chance she could, but it just became clear there was just so much against her, and she couldn't give us kids, you know, a stable life, and she thought we deserved that. So I think, you know, she made such a big sacrifice in doing that for us.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, she was a really capable mother. There was just, and I think that is the thing with foster care. I think we think about it as kids that have parents that just do drugs all the time and just don't like love them or care for them or anything like that. But I don't think it is that most of the time. Most of the time it is parents who have strayed from something and need a bit of help. I think most kids in care are there because, you know, at that time, their parents just can't be good parents for them.
Do you have any sort of relationship with your mum now, with your biological mum? Like, have you spoken to her?
Oh, yeah, I do.
So you've spoken to her about all
of
this?
Yeah, I talk to her all the time. I've actually got to call her tonight.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, no, I have. I think every time we see each other, it kind of ends up being this conversation because she still, it's almost like she's gaslighted herself into believing that she was an awful mother. And I always feel like I have to remind her, like, you were an amazing mother. You know, there were times where maybe you could have been better, but I think every mum is like that. And she did what every mum is supposed to do and make the right decision to keep her kids safe.
Yeah.
And, you know, she did that at great personal sacrifice.
And is she okay? Is she in a safe place now?
Yeah. No, she's awesome. She's got a house in Canberra. My little brother actually moved in with her when he aged out of care.
Oh.
She's the hardest worker I've ever met. She actually, she busted her knee and was just like, no, I have to go back to work. And then she ended up having to get surgery and all this stuff, but she was just so adamant she needed to go back to work. So she's a very hard worker. You know, she lives a life that she's pretty happy with. You know, it's just kind of sad to see that she had to sacrifice so much for us kids to live the life that we had to.
Yeah, but at least it sounds like everything kind of worked out in the end for you all, which is great.
Yeah, I think so.
It doesn't always happen.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
So when you were 8 years old, 7 years old, did you understand what was happening when this happened, when she had to give you up?
I mean, I think I really did, because I remember the whole experience of the caseworker coming to take us, and I just remember my brother kind of yelling, like, don't let them get you, don't let them get you, like, you have to run. And he ran off and I was there with my little brother, and like, we were trying to get away because there was this kind of thing of like, they're a stranger. You don't want to go with them to start with. But we did know who docs were, and we did know that, you know, people might try and take us away. So we had that awareness of it. But then again, when you're 7 years old, you don't really know too much about your life, and you just kind of go with whatever's happening to you. And I think that was more it. Like, I remember getting in the car with my little brother. My older brother ended up going straight to another foster home. Me and my little brother, and we ended up getting Maccas on the way home. And it was kind of this weird experience of, okay, like, this adult's got us Maccas, I guess we can trust them. And then they dropped us off at the doorstep of this family and said, you know, turned to us and said, like, oh, this is your new family now, you're going to be staying here. So I think when you're a kid, the things that happen to you are just the things that happen to you, and you're not used to having control. So I'd never really, you know, kind of fought that experience as a kid, but I do remember it being kind of weird, like, I don't really know these people. I don't want to stay here. I want my mum. Like, where is my mum? And I was very protective of my mum. And there were a lot of times where I remember as a kid where she'd be like, oh, I'm just ducking down the road to get some pizza. And, you know, she never really was ducking around down the road to get pizza. But, you know, she would leave the house for a while. And I remember watching out the window until she'd come home, because she would always come home.
Yeah.
And I remember that feeling too as a kid. I was like, mum must be so scared. She doesn't know where we are. Like, she's going to come home. She always comes home. So I think the biggest thing I remember from that time was, you know, not being super scared to be with some strangers, but I was just so worried because I was like, my mum is going to be worried. She's going to be looking for us. Like, she needs to know where we are. She needs to be here. So I think that was the main thing I remember.
Wow. What was that first family and home like for you?
Oh, they were lovely. They were really, really lovely. In my experience, like, there's a lot of foster carers out there, but I think they kind of fall into three categories. There's the really lovely ones that realize there's space in their family and they have the skills to fill that space with a kid that might need a bit of extra help. And, you know, like, yeah, cool. Like, we can take on a foster kid. We can give this child the love and care that they need. That's one kind. Then there's also the kind that's like, this is not a bad paycheck. It's just looking after a kid. What's the worst that can happen? And then there's the other one that just likes the idea of being a bit of a, it's kind of like a savior complex of, I am such a great person because I've taken in this kid that is a nightmare and no one likes, you know? So those are the three kinds. So this family that we went first, they were definitely the first kind. They were so lovely. Yeah, they did everything they could to look after us and I guess help us with the process because it must be really hard to be these adults looking after these two kids that just have no idea what's going on. So they were lovely, but they had a young son and she was pregnant and we ended up having to leave because she was pregnant with another child who had, you know, just a lot of health complications and it was kind of taking it on her. So she couldn't, you know, give us the care that we needed as two very angry, frustrating little kids. So they ended up, yeah, moving us on to another carer who was very lovely. But we bounced around from carer to carer until we got the, like, kind of final court case that says, okay, look, these are all short-term carers you've been with. It's time to move on to a long-term care. And I ended up moving long-term carers almost as much as short-term carers because it took a long time to find a good fit. But my brother and I got separated quite young, so he ended up in a lot less foster homes than I did because, I don't know, I guess he was just an easier fit.
When you say short-term versus long-term, can you explain the difference?
So there's a few differences, and I might get this wrong, so there'll probably be social workers listening. But from what I remember and from what I understand, there's quite a few different types. There's kind of like, you know, emergency, and there's like infant care and all that sort of stuff. But emergency is like, these kids have been taken tonight. They just need a bed and somewhere safe. They might go to a different foster care home in the morning. That's kind of emergency. Then there's short term, which is, you know, like, okay, they just need a little place to stay until we work out what's going to happen with them, either going into a long term home or, you know, waiting for the court case to happen where, you know, it's going to be determined whether they'll be reunified with the family or kept in long term care. And then there's also respite, which is kind of like, we'll send the kid here for the weekend so the foster carers can have a break. So yeah, I was in a lot of short-term homes until the court case, which said that, yeah, these kids need to be in care until they turn 18. So then once after that court case, it was, you know, time for us to find long-term homes. So I ended up staying in a few homes for 3 years. There were actually three homes I stayed at for 3 years and moved around kind of in between them.
Okay. What is that experience like going from house to house, from family to family?
Kind of like what I was saying before, like when you're a kid, the things that happen to you are just the things that happen to you. I feel like it's kind of hard for me to explain because it's like, you know, I don't understand what it's like to grow up in a, you know, nuclear, two parent, 1.6 siblings, one dog house with a swimming pool. So it's kind of like, you know, I know what it's like to grow up moving around and that was very normal for me. And I feel like I was pretty good at moving around. Like I was good at making friends and making myself comfortable and just kind of rolling with it. But I feel like overall, if I was to try and sum it up, like kind of moving around like that was probably like a childhood of helplessness and kind of like in that a childhood of trust. Like I had to trust all the adults around me to make the right decisions for me and my life because I literally had no control over it. Like if I wanted to live with my mom, which is what I wanted to do, or, you know, stay at a certain school, or even take up an after school sport or get a haircut, like I didn't have control or say over that. I just had to roll with everything that happened and hope that the long list of adults that were hired to make good decisions for me were doing the right thing by me. And like more often than not, I'd say they probably did. A lot of the time they didn't, but that's fine. There's a lot of people involved. I just feel like I lived in a childhood that, you know, nothing was promised and things could and would change really rapidly. You know, I lived with carers that were pretty awful, treated me awfully, refused to take me to like academic competitions or sports carnivals because, you know, it wasn't worth the effort when I was just going to end up like my mum, as they'd say. Yeah, no, good on them. Egg on their face. You know, I lived in places that made me feel really unwanted and worthless and like I had no hope of being anything but that. So I feel like I had to kind of, you know, work hard to not believe those things I was told and, you know, push myself to accept that a crappy childhood, you know, had no power over the rest of my life. But, you know, the statistics of kids in care are awful. I don't know if you've seen any, but kids who grow up in care are so much more likely to commit crimes or end up homeless, so much less likely to go to uni or let alone finish high school. So I feel like looking back now though, I'd say that kind of tumultuousness of my childhood has come in handy as an adult. Like I feel like I'm pretty good at making new friends and I'm good in new situations, you know, from all the times I rocked up on a random's doorstep and told that they were my new parents or, you know, had to stand in front of a class on my first day in a uniform that didn't fit and say three interesting things about myself. Like, I feel like I'm pretty good with change and adapting and nothing really phases me too much because I feel like I've got the skills and a history of, you know, being in situations that aren't great and somehow finding my way out. So I feel like, to sum it up, like, foster care was pretty rough, but overall, like, not bad. I got to meet a lot of people who in some way shaped my life. And despite, you know, experiencing things maybe I shouldn't have and wished I didn't, all those things got me to where I am today. So I guess I can't be too mad about it.
It's a very good attitude to have about everything.
I mean, what else can you do, right?
Yeah. So were you in 16 different families? Is that correct?
Well, actually, I'm pretty sure it's more than that. There were some that I couldn't find. But a lot of those families that I, you know, kind of tracked down and worked out where I'd lived for this project I did, they were a lot like respite homes, like places I might have only stayed at for a couple of weekends or, yeah, places I wasn't at for long but still were a part of my history. So I was like, you know what, they deserve to be captured too. So there are a few where I was out for, you know, good stretches of times, like from 3 months to 3 years. So all manner of lengths.
And different schools. You touched on that a bit before. So
yeah.
Did you move around to different places and had to go to different schools?
Yeah. I think it was around 20 schools, like primary schools.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's including ones from refuges. But to be honest, moving schools was the absolute best thing at that age. I was about, I think year one, year two, that overlap was when I moved the most. So I went to probably about 15 schools just in that time. And my mum had this... Yeah, because, you know, we were, especially from moving refuge to refuge, we were in quite a few in Sydney and, you know, with that meant a new school. And sometimes, like, we'd rock up and the school would be like, no, the kids have to be in uniform. And it's like, my mum's like, I don't have the money for a uniform and I'm probably going to have to move in a week. So, you know, that was always a bit frustrating, but I had a lot of fun with it. I would start at new schools and I would almost reinvent myself. I'd pretend to be, you know, either a super, super quiet kid that didn't even talk and was too nervous to even, you know, join in class conversations, or I pretend to be like some wild child, which I feel like is the one that stuck. And also too, like, I had this little scheme going where I would, you know, once I got my new library card, I would go to the library, borrow out as many books as I wanted, usually the Babysitter's Club, and then we'd end up leaving the school and never going back. Love the Babysitter's Club. The Netflix adaptation, perfect in every single way. Absolutely perfect.
So you took the books with you?
Yeah, stole them. Absolutely stole them. My mum called me a little while ago and she was like, hey, I'm just clearing out the storage unit from Sydney and there's like this box of books with different library stickers on it. Like, do you know anything about that? And I was like, oh, might have been Lloyd. Like, I reckon he would have stolen those books.
Is that your brother?
Yeah, that's my little brother. He definitely didn't read The Babysitter's Club. It's a great book. He should have. But no, like, I feel like I found lots of ways within that kind of crappy time of just moving schools to, I guess, pick up a lot of skills and have a bit of fun with it. You know, I learned a lot about myself in, you know, having to introduce myself so many times and, you know, being able to reinvent myself each time. And I made like a lot of friends that didn't last long. So I feel like that made me, you know, better now at understanding people and learning a lot about people in a short amount of time. And I learned about rainforests, like 6 different schools in a row. So I'm pretty good at understanding rainforests and long division. So yeah, it was kind of fun, to be honest. But yeah, I guess putting it on paper, like, I had a friend once who told me, you know, yeah, like, she really struggles in school because she went to 4 different primary schools. And I just remember being like, bruh, that's nothing. I feel like it kind of does seem a bit crazy on paper when I think about it. But, you know, like I said, when you're a kid, the things that happen to you are just the things that happen to you and you just kind of have to roll with it.
I think it's amazing, though, that you've turned out the way you have, because having that instability in your childhood, I didn't realize you'd been to so many primary schools. Like, just moving around and not having that stability and, I don't know if it's safe. Would it be safety? Did you feel safe?
I don't know. I feel like a lot of the time I didn't feel safe because there was so much uncertainty. Like, I never felt stable. Mm. I didn't know if I was going to be there the next day. Like, I never really tried too hard making friends because it was like, I probably won't show up the next day at the rate I know. So I guess there was that. I guess I just found other things to put my safety in. Instead of being like, I might have to leave this school tomorrow, I might have to leave this home, I don't know where I might be sleeping tomorrow. Instead, I've put my, you know, idea of safety in that, yeah, cool, I might not be in the same place tomorrow, but that's happened to me before and I've, you know, I've learned lots of things and I've come out okay. So I just need to remember that. So I guess that's the thing. It's like, it does sound pretty chaotic and maybe awful, but moving a lot, I guess, kind of taught me to have that sense of safety built in things that aren't permanent and to just trust that whatever happens, like, I'll be able to get through it because I have plenty of times before and the next time I move might not be any different, you know, and I can still make friends the next time and maybe I'll learn a new sport. And I think that's kind of all it really came down to, was that I, as much as there was a lot of things out of my control, I still had control over what I was going to do in the situations and how I was going to think about them.
That's amazing. That's an absolutely amazing attitude. Really. Wow.
I mean, hey, I don't know how I got it. I feel like it's a helpful attitude.
Yeah.
But like that being said, I feel like it is worth mentioning that in primary school, I was an absolute demon of a child. And I learned really early on that people, like I could get away with things because people felt sorry for me for the situation I was in. So I would regularly climb trees at recess and read Harry Potter books all the way through till lunch and refuse to go to class. And I got away with it. So I guess that's another benefit too. I had a lot of fun doing things like that.
Yeah, well, you learn how to make the best of it.
Yeah, like I think I remember I was the school I was at when I realized people, like I could get away with anything. Like I think I stole something from another kid and like ripped it. And then the teacher came over at me and I just remember my heart kind of sinking. I was like, oh no, I'm going to get in trouble. And they were just like, oh, look, it's okay. Like, why don't you sit outside? Like, you know, here's a lolly, go sit outside. I know things are hard. And I was like, what? What do you mean? Okay, I see how things work now. And yeah, I definitely took advantage of that for a very long time. And then I think when I was about 12, I was like, oh, I don't like this anymore. I might just be a normal person, you know, and be reasonable and not be so crappy.
So when you were 15, you were at a school that you wanted to stay at. What was the reason behind you wanting to stay there? What was different about that particular school?
So I think like from jumping from school to school so often, I never really invested into my schooling because what was the point of trying hard when I was probably going to be learning a different thing the next week? But I was always a really like quite a smart kid. I never struggled with the education side of school. But yeah, I never really bothered to kind of make friends or invest, kind of plant my roots. But at this school, like I'd been there for 3 years at that point. It was the only high school I ever went to. So, you know, I had friends, I had teachers. The teachers there are amazing. I had teachers that encouraged me and, you know, knew about me and that was fine. You know, like I wasn't just the weird kid there whose parents didn't love her. Like I was the kid that joined every sports team and was in detention a bit and somehow smashed every test without seeming like they tried. You know, I had friends that would invite me over to sleepovers, even though I couldn't go. I got invited to birthday parties. I had friends to wait in the canteen line with. You know, I loved my classes. Instead of just coasting, you know, I started working hard and was like really excited about learning about malleable metals and things like that. So I was trying hard and it was paying off. So, you know, it wasn't something I wanted to lose. I think that school was probably one of the first times that I realized that stability was like a real thing and that it was worth putting in the effort. So I remember when the foster home I was in from 12 to 15 broke down, I remember just being terrified because I didn't want to lose this school. It was the first time that I had that kind of feeling of, no, I don't want to go. I don't think I'll be okay. Like, I have a chance here. I have friends here. I'm doing good here. Like, please don't take me away from it.
So you were going to be moved into a group home at this stage?
Yeah. Well, that was the most likely situation because, yeah, no one really wants to take in the teenagers.
But you didn't end up there. So what happened?
So I remember I was staying at a respite home that had been staying out for like a bit of time. They were like kind of my weekend carers. But when my foster home broke down when I was 15, they took me in full time. And it wasn't the exact, they were lovely, super lovely, but they also did a lot of respite for other kids. So my bedroom was just filled with beds and there'd be screaming kids there every weekend. And it was just not a stable place to stay, not somewhere I could stay to do my HSC or for super long term. So I remember moving in there and dealing with the screaming kids and not really having access to a computer or, you know, only had one school uniform when I moved there because my carer threw out all my other stuff. So, you know, I was rocking up to school every day in the same dirty uniform. I couldn't hand in typed assignments. I wasn't able to study. So my marks dropped pretty heavily. And my science teacher at the time kind of noticed and he called, like he's told me this story a few times, he called, you know, my caseworker and talked to the other teachers too. He's like, I'm worried about this kid. And at that time, I hadn't really told anyone anything because I was a bit of a private person. He just realized something has to be wrong. This kid doesn't look like they're sleeping. They're not studying, like something's up. So I called my caseworker and the caseworker was like, oh no, like don't stress. They're safe. Nothing's wrong. You know, they'll be moving soon. Like we're just trying to find a long-term place for them. So, you know, don't worry. They're not in any danger. And he went home that night and spoke to his wife about it and was like, I'm a bit worried about this kid because they've said that they're trying to find like, you know, a long-term kind of group home. And I don't think that's going to be the right thing for this kid. Like he knew enough about me to know that I was pretty smart and I had potential that maybe could be ruined if I was sent to a group home. And, you know, he'd heard about group homes and knew about what goes on there, I guess, just that it's not the best environment for someone who's still young and needs love and care and support. So, yeah, went home and talked to his wife and, you know, the next day called back the caseworker and said, cool, well, how do we become foster carers? And then they went through the process unbeknownst to me.
Well, so you didn't know?
No, I had no idea. I was just chilling in the room filled with screaming children, just waiting. Took about eight months, I think I was there. Yeah, I remember my caseworker picked me up from school one day and took me up the road for a milkshake. And she told me, she's like, we found carers for you. And I was like, I don't think you have, but okay. And she's like, no, we found carers for you. They're lovely. They've gone through the process. Everything's clear. You can move in soon. And I was like, who is it? She's like, you know them. And I was like, who is it? She was like, it's the Harrisons. And I like honestly couldn't believe it. I thought I was being punked because I couldn't believe these two people who were like so lovely wanted me, let alone like, you know, they'd met me. So I was like, not only is it weird that two people want me, but people that know who I am. I mean, I say I was a smart kid, but I was still a problem child. Like I was in detention a fair bit. I was a naughty kid. So it was just a bit crazy to think that. I didn't really have like low self-esteem, but I was in the habit of being unwanted and feeling like a burden. So to hear people that, you know, actually knew me, wanted me, seemed like absolutely unbelievable.
Were you close to them at the time? Like, did they know you very well?
Well, so my mum now, so she was the maths teacher. I'd never been taught by her except for she like substituted my art class, in which I helped, basically tricked one of my other friends in the art class to lock her in the art room cupboard. So that was my interaction with her. Everyone called her Dragon Lady because she was so strict about people wearing hats. So she was the Dragon Lady because she was running around and like, I'll give you a detention if you don't put your hat on. So to be honest, I remember being like a little bit scared of her because all I knew was that she taught like all the big kids. Like she was like the senior school maths teacher. And she gave everyone detentions for not wearing hats. So I didn't really know her too much, but I knew my science teacher very well because my friends, like at that time, I was really into Doctor Who, the 11th Doctor, and none of my friends would let me talk about the Doctor and or the latest episode that it aired. So I would talk to my science teacher about it, and we had this like kind of friendship going, just talking about Doctor Who for like 20 minutes before class started. So I think that was it. Like I knew my science teacher pretty well, but yeah, I didn't know like my mum, who was the maths teacher, well at all.
So were you happy when you heard this news or what was your reaction?
Yeah, like I think my process of reactions was first like absolute disbelief, like you're pulling my leg here. Then my second one was kind of scary. Like I remember being really scared because I was like, this is risky. I've got the school I'm doing well at. Like what if they take me in and they hate me and I ruin this too? Because at that time, I kind of had this belief and understanding that the reason why all my homes had failed was, you know, me. I was the common denominator. And I think to an extent that was true. Like I wasn't an easy kid. I was angry about a lot of things. I made things challenging. But I also don't think I had the best run of carers up until then. So, you know, there's a lot to it. But I would think then, you know, I was the common denominator. And, you know, now I have something to lose. I could lose my school in going here. I could have people hate me. You know, I could ruin everything for this family, essentially. Like, that was my initial fear. But then I just remember thinking, I've got nowhere else to go. Like, this is my one opportunity. This is my one chance. And I think I remember talking it over with my caseworker. I just remember saying to her, like, what if this doesn't work out? Like, what if they want to get rid of me too? And she was like, you really don't have anywhere else to go. Like, it's worth a shot. So I think that was really more my thought process. I was happy to an extent, but that happiness was so wrapped up in fear because I knew, like, things never went well. Things would go well and then they would fall into a trash heap. So I think I was just so scared of that happening.
So did this home, when you went to their home, did it feel different?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I still remember driving down the driveway and seeing the house, and I'm pretty sure my jaw like literally dropped because it was the most beautiful house I'd ever seen. I felt like I was living a life straight out of the pages of Anne of Green Gables because this house was beautiful and there were trees and it was massive and it was going to be my house. Like, it was almost unbelievable. And they took me in and introduced me to their sons, who were a lot older and like just really cool. And they're like, hey sister, like come on, we'll show you your room. And I had this massive room, like I've never seen such a big room. It was bigger than most people's lounge rooms. You know, it had cupboards and drawers and air conditioning, and I had my own bed, and I went in and like kind of dumped my trash bag full of stuff. And, you know, my mum said to me, she's like, oh, we'll have to go up to the shops tomorrow and we'll pick you out a doona cover. Like, I didn't want to get you one because I wanted you to like find one you liked. And just even from there, it was just like, it was so, so clear from the start that I wasn't just a visitor. Like, I was getting brought into this family that wanted me to not only to join it, but to add to it and to feel like home in it, you know, and I don't think I'd really experienced that before. I think carers, like, they do their best to try and make you comfortable, but because they weren't, the Harrisons, they weren't foster carers, they became foster carers to take me in, they came at it totally differently. You know, it wasn't a matter of just trying to make me fit in with what they had. It was like, okay, well, here is this new person in our family, how can we fit around them and their needs and what they want to do? So, totally different.
And with the knowledge that they were going to keep you forever as well.
Yeah. And they kept saying that. They kept saying that like kind of over and over. And I think they knew more than I was self-aware that I had this kind of this distrust in people that would say things like that, because it never stayed like that. And they would tell me all the time, like, you know, you're not a burden here. We love having you here. And I remember when I moved out at 18 and, you know, went to uni and did my own thing. And then I ended up moving back when I was about 20. I remember sitting on the couch and my dad said to me, he said, it feels like home now that you're back. I think that was really the time when I realized, like, I was able to look back and think, like, absolutely, like, this is my home. And it feels more like home now that I'm here.
How much did that and them change your life?
I don't think it can be qualified or quantified. Like, I guess there's a butterfly effect to every single decision, every single thing that happens to you, whether you realize it or not. And without them, like, I can't even begin to imagine where my life would be. There's no way I would have been able to finish high school, I don't think. I wouldn't have the opportunities I have. I wouldn't be where I am. So, you know, it's the sort of thing that's like every good thing in my life from that point is because of them. It's because of the decision they made to take me in. Like, I mean, who knows? I could be a millionaire if they didn't take me in because of the way the butterfly effect works. Who knows? But I am very happy with what I've got because of them. And I couldn't imagine, yeah, I just couldn't imagine what my life would be like if it wasn't for them.
That's fantastic. So you are now a photographer and a graphic designer, but how did you actually get into photography and how old were you when you got your first camera?
So I got my first camera probably when I was about 11, I think. It was for Christmas. And then on Boxing Day that year, I watched it get snatched out of my bag as I was being pulled up the Tower of Terror at Dreamworld. So that was my photography career over from age 11. I know, it was awful. They put them in like wooden tubs that you could see the opening for, and like one of the guys in the next line, like I just saw him reach down and grab it. And I was screaming the whole way, not because of the ride, although it was quite the Tower of Terror, because I was like, that's my camera. Oh, like, no. Damn, son, stop the ride. I want it. And yeah, never saw it again. After that, I didn't get my next camera till I was 18. I always wanted to get into photography. I had friends who had cool cameras and I just loved the idea of being able to capture stuff like that. So I saved and saved and saved. And once I had probably the exact dollar amount that I needed to buy the camera that I had my eye on, I went, like, caught the bus straight to Camera House and bought the sucker. And I remember I posted like a photo of it on Instagram that night being like, yes, I got a camera. Life is good. Super excited. And then one of my friends messaged me and she was like, oh, dude, like, cool camera. The magazine I work for like needs a photographer for this festival and I'm writing it. It'd be really cool if you come. Like, do you want to come take photos for it? And I was like, oh, yeah.
What's the worst
that can happen? Yeah, I loved live music. I was super into music. And I couldn't really afford to go to gigs and festivals. So I was like, this is my chance to go to a festival. Yeah, I'll come. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm sure. I'm like, what's the worst that can happen? I literally had no clue what I was doing. I shot the whole thing on an 8 gigabyte SD card in JPEG with one battery, a 3-day festival. I pumped the ISO because I had no idea what it did, only that it made the night shots brighter. But somehow the photos turned out okay. And the magazine ran like a 20-page spread using them. So I guess it was all fine. But looking back now, it's like, oh, dude, you couldn't have even Googled how to do things. Like, couldn't have gotten a spare battery. Like, I have 15 batteries now. Yeah, I don't know how. But, I mean, maybe shooting in JPEG doesn't use as much battery. That's all I can say.
So how did you get into wedding photography? How did you go from that to wedding photography?
Yeah, purely on accident. Like, absolute accident. Not long after that festival, I had this friend message me. Her, like, wedding photographer went MIA. And so she messaged me. She's like, hey, you've got a camera. Like, could you do our wedding? And I was like, again, I've never been to a wedding, but what's the worst that could happen? It'll be fine. So I rocked up, shot it. Like, luckily by then, like, I had a bit more of an idea on how to do it. I'd, you know, taken photos more for fun and I had better lenses and stuff. So it all went well. I think I did an absolutely amazing job. I was stoked with it and they were very stoked. So after that wedding, I effed off to New Zealand and did like a season snowboarding. And when I came home, had all these messages from people who were friends with that couple being like, hey, like, you did Paige and Caleb's wedding. Could you maybe do ours? And I was like, yeah, why not? Like, I've got nothing going on, sure. So, like, by the time I had, like, a few inquiries, I was like, oh, I could start a business doing this. I like money. Let's make money. That sounds great. So I just started a business and it kind of snowballed from there. You know, I got heaps of inquiries. And even now, like, with COVID canning all of my weddings, like, next year's still looking to be pretty cool. You know, I love wedding photography and like photography in general because of what it can do. Like, you know, it's this handheld gadget that I still don't understand the science behind it and how it was even invented, but can do something really powerful, can capture memories and kind of like a moment in time. It can show like, hey, this is where you were on this day and this is what you looked like and you were really happy. And being able to do that for people is an absolute gift, as cliche as that sounds. Like, you know, I don't have many photos growing up, so I'm not sure what I look like at 7 and 8. Like, were my teeth still crooked? Did I still have blonde hair? Mm-hmm. You know, like, I can't go back and find out. But right now, like, I can take photos and I can give that to someone else. I can show them what they look like and where they were and what their memories are. And it's very, very cool.
Is that one of the reasons why you like the wedding photography? Because there's obviously lots of different avenues you can go into in photography. Why did you stick with the weddings?
There's really good food at weddings. And really good food. Oh, like caprese salads and pork belly and trays of oysters. Like, yeah, I mean, that is a big reason. But I think wedding photography, like, they're big days. So, you know, it is good money, but they're big days and you have this opportunity to kind of follow this person on the best day of their life. Like, a lot of the time I meet my couples beforehand, but sometimes I'm rocking up, I'm meeting them when they're getting their makeup on. And I get to capture these moments that are going to be looked back on for probably their whole life and the whole life of their family. You know, I get to follow them on the happiest day of their life, take these photos, get to know them. By the time speeches roll around, like, I've found out why these people are so special and why they have so many people around them. They're always really amazing people. And it's just so cool to be able to, you know, be brought in as a stranger to the happiest day of someone's life and such an important day in the lives of their family and hang around and then capture the mementos for it. So I think, like, I think a lot of, you know, my skills come in handy with wedding photography. Like, I'm pretty good at meeting new people, pretty good at making people feel comfortable. And those are two things that I think are really important in wedding photography. So I think that's why it's kind of the one I've stuck with. But really, it does pay the best. It's hard to find a branch of photography that pays better than wedding photography. And I would love to own a house one day. So look, the money does help. But yeah, I don't think I'd be doing it if I didn't actually love it.
Well, something a bit different that you did do, though, was an exhibition where you photographed 40 houses that you had lived in. Can you explain why you did that and what that was about?
So there was this art show that I'd been involved in. It was like a local art show before, and they always have a set theme. And one year they had the theme home. And I'd had this idea kind of like ticking around the back of my head of it'd be really cool to go to all these houses and take photos, but that would cost a lot of petrol and a lot of time trying to work out all the addresses, but maybe one day. So when they announced that the theme was home, I was like, brah, I'm going to steam them. I've got the best idea. So I went and I loaded up the car with some petrol, took photos of all these houses, and I just remember, like, I don't think I thought too much into what it would feel like. In my head, I was just like, I'm just going to drive by, wind down the window, take a quick shot. If it's shit, that's fine. I'll just drive off. Like, you know, I was being really quick about it, not really thinking too hard into it. And then I remember, like, on the day as I was there taking the photos, like, kind of looking at the house and not really feeling, I guess, kind of anything per se. Like, it didn't really bring back memories. But, you know, as I idled down the curb, it was kind of like this moment where I realized that whatever happened in that house, whether it was good or bad, it was still a part of my story and played a part in shaping me into who I am. And I think that was kind of, it was important, you know, and that's why maybe I was taking the photos to be like, this is where I came from. These are the places I went and they all added something to me. Yeah, I think that was really the goal without realizing it. You know, I definitely didn't go into the project with that goal, but I think I worked it out by the end. And I think that's what art really is, isn't it?
Yeah. And you did speak, did you have social workers and people in the industry come to the exhibition?
Yeah. So I ended up, like, that was actually a few years later. I had told a friend about it, I think. And then I did this article with the ABC and they mentioned it. And then actually it was the FACTS Better Practice Conference. I think that's what they call it. It was the belong. They had the theme of belonging, I think. It was a while ago now. Anyway, but it was this FACTS conference for, you know, all kind of caseworkers to come to. And I was just doing kind of like a little breakout session where people could come in. We'd made this video featuring the houses with some kind of audio over it, explaining what the houses were and stuff. But the main part of that project was actually talking about this anecdote that I say when people ask me what the hardest thing about growing up in foster care was. I always say it was doing the washing. Because the thing that people don't realize about moving around so much is that as a kid, you're expected to just show up on this person's doorstep and just understand their family dynamic. Like, people don't realize how weird families are, you know, like whether the sauce goes in the fridge or the cupboard or where the glasses go or if there's a poo knife. Like, there's families are weird. Families are very weird. But as a kid, you rocked up and you're expected to just understand and know where the towels go. And it's kind of like that with the washing. Like, I remember anytime I'd help foster carers hang out the washing, I'd get hit with the, oh no, silly, that's not how you hang up a t-shirt. And it's like, what, this was fine the last time. So yeah, I kind of had that as a theme. So we had people walk in and hang up a shirt. And I remember standing back watching. And it was so funny because that exact same thing happened. Someone will rock up and they'd hang a shirt, you know, they'd peg from the bottom. And the person like next to them be like, what? That's not how you hang up a t-shirt. Like, you got to fold it in half. It's not going to dry like that. Like, you're just letting the bottom go wet. And then, you know, some people wouldn't even use pegs. Like, there were so many different ways people would hang up the washing. And that was kind of like the main theme. But then, yeah, people would come in and do that. And then they'd watch the video that we'd created with the houses. It was really cool to be able to see that project that didn't really have any major goals do something like that, because people then, these caseworkers who have seen that kids live in a lot of homes, actually had this visual kind of moment of being able to see, like, this is what 40 houses looks like in a kid's life. And one of the girls working on the project came up with the best idea that I wish I could take credit for, was that she had the photos displayed for as long as I was there for. So some of them were really quick, some were really like kind of long, but you know, it was all like a percentage of my childhood timed for, which absolutely brilliant. But yeah, I'd included houses in that, you know, like my childhood home, the home, like the houses that my mother lived in when I'd see her, because we'd spend a lot of time like visiting my mum. So kind of anywhere she lived was almost like a second home for me. So there were a lot of houses within that. And I also included like the house I lived, like I moved to when I turned 18. I'm pretty sure I've lived in another like 10 houses since then. And I can't be bothered taking photos of them because the project's done. But yeah, no, it was really cool to see, people in that realm and in that sphere see all the photos and let it have a bit of an impact. So, yeah, it was a cool project.
So this was 40 houses up until you turned 18?
Yep.
Wow. It's like more than 2 houses a year.
I mean, yeah, pretty much. But then when you think about it, from 1 to 4 was just 2 houses. And then from 5 to about 11 was probably like 20 to 30. And then, yeah, the last 10 would have been over the course of, you know, 4 to 5 years. So I guess kind of there was just that one space in the middle where it was like moving every second week or whatever. So I think that really added to it, definitely makes it look a bit more hectic than maybe it was. But yeah, even still, I think moving families as regularly as I did isn't that heard of. I mean, I know people who have lived in the same house their whole life. So, yeah. You know, I think for those people, it must be, I can't understand what that's like, and they definitely can't understand what 40 houses might look like either.
Yeah. Wow. So what do you hope for your future?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I hope that I can have some opportunities to, I guess, use my story and my experience to help other kids. Like, currently I'm working with Sydney University on some projects, creating resources for kids in care, which has been going really well. Really stoked with how everything's looking. And it's really cool to have that opportunity to, you know, use my voice and my experience to help kids not have the same experiences. And I think that it's almost rare. Like, a lot of kids like me tend to either, you know, kind of want to just move on from the things they've gone through. But I really enjoy being able to incite change where I can. So I hope I get lots of opportunities to do that. I hope I can buy a house one day. That would be great. But I guess otherwise, yeah, I don't know. I just hope that whatever I end up doing, it's something that makes me happy and makes me proud.
I love that. If you bought a house, would you stay in that for the rest of your life? Would that be weird for you?
That's the thing. Like, Yeah, I absolutely wouldn't. It wouldn't be weird because it's been my absolute dream. Like, I've lived in so many other people's houses. I just want to have one that's mine where I can paint the walls and I can put thumbtacks and I can have a Coke machine in the kitchen because that's all I want. You know, I want something that is mine, that is home for me and my family and, like, hopefully could live in it forever. That would be the dream. You know, who knows? But, yeah, that's it. I'm sick of moving all the time and living in other people's places. I want something that is mine that I can build for myself.
Yeah.
Maybe my family as well. They can have their own rooms as well.
Well, I hope you get to do that.
Oh, me too. We'll see. Yeah. Who knows?
I do have one final question that I ask everyone at the end of their interviews. So if you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Yeah, look, I don't think I would. I don't think I'd bother. Like I was saying before, the butterfly effect, you never know what one little tiny thing can do to affect the course of someone's life. So I don't think I would give any advice. Like, somehow without hindsight, like, I managed to get to a place where I am, where I'm happy and fulfilled with goals and dreams that I've reached and am reaching. So I don't think I'd say anything to my younger self because I don't think I need to. Like, younger me took all the right steps to get me here. And I mean, I might tell younger me to brush my teeth more to avoid fillings or to stand up straighter to have a better posture or maybe just maybe invest in Bitcoin. But I think she handled everything else pretty beautifully, and I don't want to do anything to change that.
That is amazing. I absolutely love your attitude and the way you've gotten to where you are now. It's just incredible. Seriously, your positivity and your ability to look at things, it's amazing.
I mean, I don't know if it's positivity. I just feel like life is 10% what happens to you and 90% what you do with it. Like, you could have a really awful day, and if you sit there and you let yourself think about how awful that start of your day was, it ruins your whole day. You know, and I've learnt over the years that anything can happen and that doesn't change my ability to live a life where that wasn't affected by it. You have the ability to control a lot more than you realize. I mean, as much as bad things that can happen can really, you know, ruin your vibe, you still have that power to change the way you want to think about them and move forward on them.
I think a lot of people can learn from that.
I mean, honestly, see people out there whinging that their car breaks down, bro, like, it's fine. Yeah, sure, it's going to be a shitty hour while you wait for NRMA, but go to Macca's. It'll be over before you know it, and then you can go on and have a nice rest of your day. Just chill out a bit. If people just chilled out a bit, we might be okay.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today. It's been incredible. It's been lovely
worries.
To speak with you. And
no,
I hope that
been.
You do get to buy a house and your wedding photography gets back in full swing.
Yeah, I've done the maths, and if I shoot about 80,000 weddings a year, I might be able to buy a burnt out little studio apartment in the Shire. But we'll see. One day. One day.
I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inspirational Tales. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you could please share it with your family and friends so that we can inspire more people. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, please don't forget to leave us a rating or a review and make sure that you have subscribed or followed the podcast on whichever platform that you are listening to it on so that you can stay up to date as new episodes are released. Thanks again, and I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of Inspirational Tales.